This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Now, when I say food waste to you, what do you think of? What is the first thing that comes into your mind? It's probably your own home. It's the food that doesn't get used, the leftovers that go in the green bin, or the veggies that are just too far gone in the crisper. And yes, that is certainly a part of the story, but it's absolutely not the whole story. My name's Nick Healy. I'm filling in for Rochelle this week. I'm in Shepparton in the Goulburn Valley. And over Christmas and into the start of this year, around where I live and further afield in areas like Swan Hill, we saw some wild weather, and it led to a lot of loss and damage when it comes to stone fruit. Hundreds of tons of fruit got damaged, neither went to waste, or maybe will get a run as stock feed. And a lot of food waste actually happens on the farming level, during processing, during packing as well. Today, you're going to hear from some of the people who've been investigating this and some of the ways we can change it and ways to ensure that the food is making a difference. But I also want to hear from you. What do you do at home to put the boot into food waste? What are your tips and tricks on getting the most from your shop, or the cleverest ways to use up that natural waste from the kitchen?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Now, some context first. In the past year, 3.7 million Aussie households, that's about 36% of the country, they have experienced moderate to severe food insecurity. We produce more than enough food to feed our entire population, and yet about a third of the food we produce is currently ending up at the tip, and food insecurity is on the rise. To tackle this, we need to look at all aspects of it, all aspects of the food chain, production through to consumption. Now, Philip Janikiewski, Senior Engineer at CSIRO's Agriculture and Food Group, he specialises in process and product development for agri-food applications. Philip, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Nick. Great to be here.
Look, I mentioned just a second ago, of course, we've seen fruit loss at the start of the year from my part of the world. I certainly know with climate change, there's strong concerns events like that are going to become more common. But just putting that to the side for 1 minute, do we have a sense of just how much food waste can occur on that farming, on that food production side?
Great to be talking food waste, Nick, and I think we've got some numbers now that point towards food waste being roughly split one third on farm, one third in the consumer side, and one third in the processing side. And if to put that into context, last year at the national level we had 7.6 million tons of food waste generated across those three parts of the supply chain. And that's a big number, but I guess if we were to picture that, if we were to fill the MCG with food waste, we would have enough food waste to fill it to the brim nine times over. Now, that's an enormous amount of food waste, especially given what you just shared around, you know, the food hunger report that was released with, you know, 3.7 million homes not having enough food or enough quality food. So I think there is so much that can be done. It's a really big challenge. It's a complex challenge, and it's and we've set some ambitious targets to reduce the food waste, you know, by 2030, by 50%. So I think we've got to do more, and I think talking about it and getting it, you know, on the front page is the first step in, you know, making change and getting especially that part at the consumer end. I think we can do more there, but also there's lots that can be done, especially in terms of on-farm and what you spoke about in terms of how we're experiencing shocks to the supply chains, and that seems to be more common these days as well.
Philip, I want to talk about those goals in a second because that is ambitious. And as you point out, we only get to reduce that food waste by actually studying where we can make an impact. But on that farming side, you know, that third that you mentioned when we talk about food waste, that can't all be disaster related, can it? Is there some natural attrition when we talk about farming and processing practices?
Yeah, so there is, and I think that traditionally farmers will probably grow a little bit more than they need to be able to meet their supply agreements with retailers and supermarkets. So you always tend to grow a little bit more to be able to cover those what's needed. And I think the part that we are seeing more of is those shocks. So the shocks that we've seen probably over the last 4 years. Now, I know you mentioned the one more recently in a sort of Goulburn Valley, and the Goulburn Valley is our fruit bowl and Swan Hill.
It is, yeah.
And we've seen a couple of those. We had one in November last year around Melbourne Cup, you know, the hailstorm that came through, and we had floods in the Shepparton and Echuca region. We saw all of the tomato crops completely covered by water. And so we've had those as well, and even going back to, you know, last year where we had a potato shortage. Now, that was really something close to my heart. You went to the fish and chip shop and, you know, you couldn't really get potatoes at one stage. And that was a result of the floods kind of covering a lot of the land where we grow potatoes, and then some fungal diseases setting in and impacting the crop that farmers were putting in. So I think we've seen a whole range of different reasons related to climate. We've seen the fires back in 2020 impacted lots of the grape growing areas, you know, in the Hunter Valley, in the Adelaide Hills, in Gippsland, and then there was the smoke taint that came from the bushfires that spread really broadly across, you know, the states. So there's just so many. We seem to be experiencing more of these shocks to the system, and we also had in between the pandemic, well, of those supply chains just simply closed down. So we had those export markets for our horticulture produce, especially places like Far North Queensland, the Burdekin, and that's a really large growing area for export into Asia. And as soon as those ports closed and we didn't have an outlet for our fresh produce, and it only has a short shelf life, so it's very difficult then. You know, what do you do with tons and tons of produce that's just sitting around? So I think there's a number of reasons, but predominantly it's you know, these kind of shocks. We also see, I think, the cosmetic standards that supermarkets have, and we can go there as well. But that's certainly another reason why some produce never really makes it to the supermarket end. It's, you know, it gets graded at the farm, and there's certainly the first quality and the second grade that may go to, you know, second grade may go to markets. And then the third grade could potentially go into things like fruit juices or purees and be processed further. And then, you know, there's always going to be a loss component as well.
Philip, we can definitely talk more about, I guess, you know, for want of a better word, making sure uglier veggies making it onto the shelf and people knowing that they're okay to eat. But it's very easy, and I just did it myself then. I talked about sort of hundreds of ton of stone fruit lost, but it's not lost. It's there. I mean, we're still talking about the actual biomass existing. Like, there's still got to be some way of disposing of that. Are we seeing innovation around what we do with that food once it has gone beyond human consumption?
Absolutely. So I think that really, again, just going back a little bit, maybe 2017 was really the breakthrough year when we saw lots of investment into innovation, and we had, at the same time, we had actually on the ABC the War on Waste, which really highlighted the problem around food waste. And the government then introduced, it was the Turnbull government, introduced the food waste strategy, which, you know, started to target, you know, reducing our food waste. And then that's sort of led to programs through the Fight Food Waste CRC, through a lot of the universities, and definitely lots of research and innovation within CSIRO and with startups coming on board to really take advantage of what's a really valuable nutrient stream rather than just a waste stream. And some of those imperfections where we've had a hailstorm or a wet, you know, really heavy rain coming through, there's some of those imperfections can be little spots, you know, a brown spot on an apple or a pear, still completely, you know, valuable in terms of what's inside the fruit, but cosmetically it may not look perfect. So it will probably never make it to the supermarket. But if we're finding those ways to convert those and preserve fruit and preserve vegetables, extend the shelf life, and there's lots of work that's been done to find ways, alternative ways, to repurpose those unused and leftover fruit and vegetables on farm.
I like the fact you called it nutrition, like you mentioned that this food is still, you know, actually having some sort of nutritional benefit. But what are some of the innovations we've seen on making sure it doesn't just end up in, you know, in a landfill?
Yeah, great. So I think if you take vegetables as an example, we've been working with some growers in Victoria that work predominantly in the brassicas, and they grow lots of cauliflower, cabbage, and broccoli, and
vastly underrated foods.
Absolutely.
Everyone, they get such a bad rap. They're fantastic foods.
Absolutely, and broccoli is one of those, and cauliflower and broccoli are one of those vegetables that tend to be hand harvested. There's someone sort of going on farm and harvesting that, but you can often have a little flower, a white flower on a broccoli, and it just doesn't meet the supermarket spec, or it might be, you know, the broccoli head, the floret might be too big. So we found ways to preserve the nutrients by drying those leftover vegetables on farm, and introducing those vegetables into new products. So if you think of a twisty, for example, we've been able to develop a product with a company called Nutri-V. It's a vegetable product, and it has a much higher vegetable content. And so you're really putting vegetables back into the diet, and it's in a really convenient format, and it's shelf-stable, and it can be, you know, consumed as a snack, or you can kind of sprinkle it onto something else as well. And so, you know, you can put it onto a salad or something that you might be having for dinner as well. So I think there are obviously different avenues. Now, the key step with all produce on farm is to be able to intervene really quickly at the point of where the produce is grown. So that means that we have to either dry the fruit or process it somehow, or freeze it. Now, freezing is really not a great way for preserving things. So producers of frozen, for example, vegetables tend to sometimes have less waste. But yeah, there are some great innovations that have come into the commercial side recently. Some of those are still at the early stages of research, and certainly, you know, the products that I just mentioned, those vegetable snacks, have made their way into now most of the retail and supermarket stores, and you can go out and buy these products. So I think it's a fantastic story, and it's recovering all of the vegetable that's grown on the farm. So I think previously we were just using the broccoli head. Now we can actually use the broccoli head, the stem, we can use the leaves, we can use the whole fruit. So it's a very, very different way of looking at the whole plant rather than just cutting the floret off the stem and putting that into the consumer side, actually repurposing the whole plant.
Philip, that is actually fascinating. I'll get you to hold on for a second because we've got a caller in. I think it's Gerard in Macedon.
I was at Docklands Stadium a couple of weeks ago for the Renegades versus Stars cricket clash, and I was absolutely sickened at the amount of food wastage I saw there. And when I mean food wastage, I mean, you know, I was sitting up on level 2 premium seating. I saw the people next to me, you know, eating their nuggets and chips and whatever. But then as the game left and we were leaving, I'm walking up the stairs and I'm looking under all the seats. So I'm just seeing so many trays that were like easily halfway full, just full of nuggets and chips. And I thought, oh my goodness, all this wasted food. And then to get onto even more sickening part of it, as you're walking out of the stadium, the amount of homeless people who are saying, can I please have some food for money? Right behind them, there's a stadium full of food that's been left under the chairs. These people understand how much money and food they are wasting.
Yeah, Gerard, I do worry that there's not a lot of sense from us as a society of what that impact is and just how much of that goes to waste. And Philip, I guess just very quickly from you, do you think that we have a good sense of how much food we waste? I mean, we talk about the amounts you mentioned, but do you think as an individual we've really got a key line on it?
I think it's still a bit of a hidden problem. And certainly on the consumer side and in food service and in restaurants and at the cricket as well, you certainly see lots of waste. Now, it's a little bit more challenging to intervene once you've sort of left, food has left the supermarkets. It's a little bit more challenging to intervene that and recycle that back into food itself. But there are great ways to utilise that as well. We're not just talking about food. We're thinking of how can we repurpose some of these scraps and leftovers into, for example, aquaculture feeds and poultry feeds and cattle feed. And can we also use it to, for example, breed insects, which are then turned into protein, and then the protein is put back into the supply chain. So I think there are ways we can use that waste, but it's certainly a little bit of a hidden, I think it's still a bit of a hidden problem, understanding and the logistics of, for example, having to collect the waste from different restaurants or from stadiums and major events. I think that there could certainly be some initiatives around those major events, like at the MCG or, large stadiums where you have lots of waste. I think the MCG did do something a couple of years back. They had some composting systems set up. So composting is a much better alternative to sending things to landfill. The amount of methane that's produced in landfill is much greater than if you're composting something. So I think there are, certainly interventions we could be thinking about, and that probably applies to the waste at home as well. Don't put it in your bin. Just start thinking about a compost bin. We've been saying that for a really long time, but now we've got the data to say, methane is 28 times more harmful to the environment than carbon dioxide. So don't send things to landfill, because eventually that will end up as a source of methane gas and a greenhouse gas. So I think there, some of the understandings around the impact of what we do is probably, but I think some more education programs, better, certainly, more data, sharing some of these stories, with consumers will certainly help us with that.
We're talking food waste today, and we're taking a big, broad look at it. We're looking at how it works on supply chains, on the agriculture side of it. But, of course, we're not ignoring what happens in our own homes. And I'd love to hear from you on how you tackle food waste in your own kitchen. Enzo Palombo is a professor of microbiology at Swinburne University. And, Enzo, good morning to you.
Morning, Nick.
In the modern world, I think one of the biggest ways we try and limit food waste compared to, say, what our parents and our grandparents were doing is by increasing its shelf life. We're trying to preserve it for a bit longer. And I know these days maybe preservatives can feel like a bit of a dirty word. There's been very much a push towards organic foods on the table and in the kitchen. I know some of your research has looked at how natural preservatives can work. In fact, if I understand correctly, Enzo, there's been some work recently looking at how viruses can help preserve food.
Yeah, exactly right. And there's some really great work being done, not just locally, but all over the world, in looking at how we can utilise some of our natural products from the world of plants and other things to help with preservation of food. And that's because many of these naturally occurring products do have their own inherent antimicrobial activity. Think of things like garlic and ginger. Those foods have natural compounds within them that help that product to last much longer and have a longer shelf life. So we can take some of these compounds and potentially add them to our foods as so-called natural preservatives. And that's one aspect of research being done across the globe.
And it feels like we're just taking old traditional knowledge and bringing it back to the fore.
Well, yes. And sometimes we forget that, you know, we've done things like this for a long time. It's not just a modern problem. This has been a problem about food and food preservation for eons. Think of fermentation and how we used to find other ways to make our food last longer. You know, milk is a great example. Milk as a product is quite perishable. But if you turn it into a cheese or a yogurt, it lasts much longer because the food becomes acidic through fermentation. And those things can be used today to make things like sauerkraut and kimchi and those sort of naturally preserved foods.
How big a difference to food waste can this research make when it comes to that end product, Enza?
I don't know if we have exact figures, but in terms of looking at some of the comments that Philip made earlier about repurposing our foods, we can take what we would think about as a waste stream potentially and use those compounds within that waste stream to then repurpose it into things like food preservation strategies. So it may make a dent in the big picture, but some of the figures presented are quite overwhelming. It's part of the solution.
Philip, in your sort of studies, has the kind of work Enzo is talking about come up?
Yeah, absolutely. And hi, Enzo. And so, fermentation's becoming really, really important. It's been around for hundreds of years as a way of preserving food. And I think we're thinking more about how we use, you know, fungal fermentation, microbial fermentation to produce food from and preserve food, but also there's a whole new, space that's looking at how can we manufacture food using fermentation from residues. So we can just take, you know, sugar cane, for example, as a really rich feedstock of sugar and then use microbial fermentation processes to generate a whole range of different ingredients. So it's really changing and challenging traditional manufacturing processes as well. But I think fermentation has so many opportunities, you know, and we can definitely do more in that space.
And so I'm keen to know why I haven't heard more about this, I guess, even colloquially. Is this kind of on the cutting edge, or is there a little bit of a barrier towards it becoming something people are embracing?
It might come back to the comment you made earlier, Nick, that, you know, we're rediscovering these things, and maybe the modern world, we think we're, you know, cleverer than our ancestors in some ways. Yeah, they knew things that we didn't know, and they would have probably observed the natural world better than we do in our sort of urban, sterile environment, and seen things happen naturally. They think, that could be used in some other application. And, you know, the point you made about using viruses to preserve food, now that's a really... So we think of it as a novel application, but it's been done for about 100 years in other contexts. There's even commercially approved products now that use special viruses that kill certain bacteria, like Listeria, which is a very nasty organism that gets into our food. And we can add these to our foods and it acts as a preservative and extends the shelf life for things like seafood, cheeses, and so on.
Hang on, Enzo, the viral work's been running for 100 years. What context has it been used in?
Mostly in what we call therapy, so more in terms of infectious diseases. But we use the same sort of concept to also combat bacteria that might get into our food and cause foodborne illness.
How intriguing. Natalie's on the line from Geelong. Natalie, you're also using a very old technique that's got a lot of love in the modern world at the moment for managing food waste.
Yeah, that's right. I just wanted to speak up for the humble chicken. we've got 6 chooks now. We worked our way up from 4, and they're really quite simple and rewarding pets to have. It's really satisfying to be able to send all your food waste either to the chooks or to the compost, and they give you back eggs and pest control in the garden and what we call chook TV, which is just watching them be funny little creatures. I just really encourage people who are chook curious to give it a go because, they manage food waste beautifully and you get so much back in return.
Thank you, Natalie. Chook curious might be my new favourite phrase. I've never heard that before. Do you have the traditional kind of chook run out the back? Are you using one of those chook tractors that people seem to have as all the rage? How are you keeping them?
We do a bit of everything. We've just got a bit of a ragtag chook yard that we've put together. We bought a fancy coop that has an automatic door because sometimes we're too lazy to get up with the chooks. And, you know, you can go away for a day or two and they take care of themselves. But the chook tractor thing, yeah, sometimes we fence off a small area and we've got plans to make a simple kind of portable cage that can move around so they can mow the lawn for us.
Natalie, I'm so glad you got in touch and thank you for that. And look, you know, it's not to get all too weird here, Philip, but it is a little bit of that almost circular look at food. You know, you are taking that food scrap, providing it to chickens and getting food in return at the end of it.
Absolutely. And I think circular is definitely the term that's you know, coming in and very much taking over from the way we have been manufacturing even food in a very linear way. And that whole circular economy and, you know, being able to repurpose, reuse, recycle materials, not just food, but in general, is so important now. And I think that chooks are a great example, you know. And, again, you know, we've spoken about just feeding them directly, but also there are options to, you know, turn some of these scraps as well into aqua feeds, into cow feeds, into so many animals that we feed. And we actually import quite a lot of ingredients, especially soy meal, that's coming from different parts of the world. We import that to feed our animals. So we could be doing that locally. We could be using our local waste streams to do that. And if you think about soy that's coming from, you know, Brazil, it's probably traveling to the US to be crushed into, you know, soy oil, and then the meal is shipped to China, and then we're getting it from, it's traveling halfway around the world. So it's not a very sustainable way to feed our animals. So I think we need to be more reliant on what we've got locally and less reliant on these imports as well. So I think lots of opportunities on the animal feed side.
Well, I mean, that changes the carbon footprint as well if we're talking local rather than import, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. And I think some you know, there's some work being done and within Saro and other parts of the country just to measure the footprint. And, yeah, it's a really interesting space, you know, just to start to understand where is your food coming from, but also where are the sort of ingredients to make the food come, you know, that are coming in. How far has it travelled? It's a really interesting question to ponder.
I got Penny on the text line saying that in terms of our waste fruit and veg in her home, it goes into the worm farm or for compost. When we're talking sort of tissues, bones, cooked meat, citrus peel, whatever, that goes into the council bins. Penny saying that they're willing to have three waste bins in their kitchen to make sure they're getting the right way through. And Enzo, I just wanted to quickly pick your brain on a text I've had in from Diana saying that she got a tip a little while ago about the way to keep veggies for longer in your own fridge. And it is about sort of getting tea towels, moistening them, layering the veggies between that in the crisper, making sure that they stay a bit wet and a bit pushed down. Veggies saying, Diana saying, they will stay fresh for so much longer. When we talk about keeping food fresh in the house, I do think sometimes there's a tendency to assume that we just put it in the fridge and walk away from it. But even within that, there's ways to think about shelf life and to think about keeping that vegetable or whatever it is for a little bit longer.
Yeah, certainly. Things like taking it out of the plastic bag, you know, when the food is inside the bag, it may create an environment which is more conducive to some sort of, you know, undesirable growth of things like microbes. But even our modern fridges have much better temperature control. And one of the things that I always stress is making sure you have your temperature dialed down correctly in both the fridge and the freezer. And I would bet that most domestic fridges at home are not set at the correct temperature.
What should be the correct temperature?
Well, usually we recommend below 5 degrees, but most would be running probably, I would say, 8 to 10 degrees potentially. And it's not the fault of the consumer, because it's hard to monitor your fridge. You open the door all the time and so on. But keeping the temperature control at the right levels is an important factor. Very much so.
Are we too leery about leftovers these days, do you think? Are we throwing out food because we think it's hit a point where we can't use it anymore?
Yeah, and perhaps, again, it goes back to this idea of repurposing. You mentioned the idea of, you know, fruit and veg. Mm. You've got a few raggy-looking bananas on the fruit on the shelf. Make it into something like a bread or banana bread or something. You know, think about how you can use that, not as a... We think of waste as an end product, but it's actually a resource to do other things. It's changing our mentality around what waste is. It's not a waste, it's a resource. So thinking a bit laterally, thinking a bit more out there and how we use our food and not being turned off by, you know, a little spot on an apple or a pear or something. Just cut it off and eat the rest. It's fine.
Look, I get in a bit of trouble in my home because I have a tendency to treat use-by dates as a serving suggestion rather than a hard and fast rule. How likely am I to end up in a hospital, Enzo?
Common sense. Use common sense. Use-by dates are mandatory by the regulators on perishable foods like, you know, your milks and so on. The other one that confuses consumers, though, is the best before date. Now, the best before is on foods that have a much longer shelf life. Mm. And therefore, it's impossible to say it's going to go off at this particular date. So they give you a sort of a guide as to say this food is going to be at its best before this date. After that date, it's still fine. It might not be its best, but it's still safe to consume. So using those dates in the right way is a good bit of advice.
And so would a better understanding for the consumer around what those dates mean and maybe even a better way of translating them onto products, would that help with food waste?
Yeah, and in fact, in the UK, I believe they've got rid of those dates, particularly the best before dates, because it was confusing the consumer. They would take perfectly edible food, and because it had a best before date of 18th of January 2024, they'd throw out the following day. Using that information properly is important, but also not confusing the consumer is just as important.
You said in the UK, is there any push towards that sort of change in Australia that you're aware of?
I believe there has been some noise being made about this. I think I was on this program last year sometime, and there was another guest talking about that push to maybe remove the best before dates locally also.
Enzo, really quickly before I let you go, had a question in on the text line saying, is it still mandatory to keep dairy on the top shelf of the fridge? Is that something you could answer?
Yeah, nothing's mandatory. I mean, you can do what you like in your home. But the advice is to maybe keep the milk and stuff like that inside rather than on the door, because the door is the part of the fridge that probably gets the warmest of all the areas.
Enzo, I did not know that, and you have been a lifesaver on that. Thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks, Nick.
Enzo Palumbo, Professor of Microbiology at Swinburne. My name is Nick Healy. I'm filling in for Rochelle this week, and I'm coming to you from Shepparton in the Goulburn Valley region of Victoria. Joining me in the Melbourne studio, Philip Janikiewski. He's a senior engineer at the CSIRO. He's with the Agriculture and Food Group, and very, very big thank you, Philip, for sticking around for so long to have a conversation on this. I actually have one of your colleagues on the phone, Pablo Giuliano, who's a group leader with the group. Pablo, good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Good to be here.
Pablo, it's been really interesting where we're talking food waste and how we're talking about ways of actually, I guess, tackling it from beyond just the average home. And I know you've taken a big look as well at what we can do on that farm. You've been mapping food and veg waste on farms, working with various companies to see what they're saying. What have you been learning?
So we've been looking at different industries, and Australia has a national food waste strategy, and part of that was to say, okay, let's draw a line and let's say, what's the baseline here, right? So you have a number of industries. We are producers of meat and poultry and milk and grains and vegetables, right? So across the value chain, and Philip was talking about 7.6 million tons, we have 22% of those that are left behind on farm, and 17% of that is on processing. So there's a lot of manufacturing industries that produce a lot of byproducts. So what we did was we took the fruit and vegetable industry, and we said, okay, let's talk to 19 and 23 fruit and vegetable farmers all around Australia, and let's put them in the map. And then let's look at how much they produce, and let's look at how much are the volumes in there. So, and then we looked at the processors of those, some of those fruits that will go into, you know, preserve peaches or pears or juices. And then some of the pomace that comes from those juices also, you know, are waste. So that gives us around 1.5 million tons of material that could be, you know, repurposed and reused in, back into foods or in feed or in other types of materials. But also that inspired in terms of the creation of models, right? So we were able to work with companies around making decisions in terms of, you know, putting some decision support tools to decide what to do with that waste. And we've been having conversations with many across the chain about that.
Is there a genuine drive to making those changes? Are you seeing a lot of interest in us, I guess, changing up how we treat that food waste?
Yes. You know that 45% of Australians today are flexitarian. So that means that everybody wants to eat more plant-based food, and then how do we increase that, and how do we increase the content of those plant-based food is actually by buying fruit and vegetable ingredients or some compounds from that that you could extract, such as fiber that you can then add back into our bread. So this sort of strategies are the ones that companies are thinking of in terms of repurposing as well, bringing this back into the foods in different forms as well.
Obviously, when we talk about food waste, for many people, you know, there's a real eye on sustainability with that, and there tends to be a bit of an idea floating around that if you are having a predominantly plant-based diet, you are naturally contributing to a more sustainable farming. Is the research there to back that up? I mean, if we are moving away from meat diets, are we actually making an impact on that sustainability, Pablo?
Unfortunately, the answer is no. It's not black and white like that. And sometimes as consumers, we make choices to go vegan or vegetarian for the wrong reasons. I mean, what we need to really know is, what is the history of those foods in terms of where you source it from? I could, for example, buy a plant-based patty that has ingredients that are sourced from overseas, and then as such, obviously the footprint of this versus a meat burger, you know, from a local source beef, you know, will have a lesser footprint. But that will also depend on what we get the cow that, as a feed. So it's, it's a very complex equation to account for all these sort of CO2 and greenhouse gas emissions. But it's more complex than that because it's also about how much water we consume. And we have areas of drought, and also what do we do with to biodiversity? So it's a very complex conversation to unpack, you know, are we really damaging the environment with one option or versus the other?
Philip, you touched on it before. You mentioned the idea of taking food waste for insect farms and how that can be used to produce proteins. I've chatted to Olympia Yaga from GoTerra more than a few times, and I know she's been working on kind of a larger scale insect farming. I'm a bit passionate about the idea that insect protein needs to be a much larger part and a better accepted part of our diets. When we talk about alternative proteins like that, are we looking at less waste necessarily?
So it's I think it, you know, what Olympia's doing is absolutely fantastic with the work on the black soldier fly and the insect protein, and I think that's becoming really really interesting from not just from a food perspective. It is probably still a way to go to get insects and consumers to accept, perhaps, you know, insect as a staple. And in terms of where that's going globally, in Europe we now have factories producing insect protein, which is going into the pet care sector. So it's going into pet food, into dog food, cat food. So that's already happening. And I think there's probably an avenue for that locally as well. You know, you could think of the protein. Essentially, yes, it's coming from an insect. So perhaps we need to, you know, get our mind around that it's still a source of protein. And there was some really interesting work that was done in 2019 where they looked at what was the impact of having, you know, would you consume a cricket, for example, versus would you consume a muesli bar that had protein made from a cricket, right? It was quite a different scenario, and consumers overwhelmingly said, you know, oh, yes, I'll have the muesli bar, but the cricket itself, not so much, right? So there is a consumer piece there and an acceptance of, you know, where can we use insect protein. But certainly I think for the feed sector, that's again, you know, there's so much value in just taking this protein source, and it's got a, you know, interesting amino acid profile. It probably needs to be fortified a little bit to you know, to cover for all the nutrient requirements for some animals. But certainly I think it's a great step forward. And I think what Pablo was sort of talking about, you know, we need to be thinking about that footprint. So if you've got local, you know, waste streams and you can easily put those into an insect protein, and potentially for the insect as well, it's an easier requirement in terms of the shelf life. You might be able to ship that slightly longer. And we sort of need these centralized facilities, I think, to be able to do that, to aggregate the waste and then to convert that into some form of protein.
I'm on the cutting edge a little bit when it comes to being very happy to tuck into a big plate of crickets, I'm sure of that. Pablo Juliano, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Is the group leader of food processing and supply chains with CSIRO.
This is where the conversation begins. ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
I'm Nick Healy, filling in for Rochelle this week. And when we're talking food waste, we have to chat to Chef Joe Barrett, chef and owner of Little Picket Restaurant. Also, in many ways, kind of the face of the zero waste movement when it comes to the kitchen. Joe, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Your debut book called, very, very simply, Sustain, Groundbreaking Recipes and Skills That Could Save the Planet. How did you become the zero waste chef?
Oh, there's a few of us. I think Matt Stone is one of them as well, and Joris Backer. I worked at his restaurant in Melbourne called Silo, and we actually were using waste from other restaurants to make bone broth, and it turned into the restaurant brothel. So I think that really sung true to me, just the impact chefs have. And at the same time, I was a baker, kind of working with flour and really closely with grain and seeing what it was like to work with an individual ingredient and seeing the whole kind of system from growing the wheat all the way through to making the bread. So you can see how the environment impacts that ingredient, and then you don't want to waste it once you've seen the resources that go into it.
So that's such a change of perspective to what normally happens in a kitchen, to drill down not just on one ingredient but its entire life cycle.
Yeah, I mean, that's what food is for us. And what I believe chefs should do is, you know, treat ingredients in real time, in season, and make sure you use the whole thing and use proven techniques to preserve abundance and build a pantry and reduce food waste.
It led you to do some really fascinating work when it came to bread, and especially repurposing bread. Could you talk me through what you've been doing?
Yeah, I started back when I was at Oak Ridge Winery in the Yarra Valley. We've got a beautiful stone mill, so we were milling grain every day to make our sourdough bread, and at the time experimenting in the garden with growing wheat. And we were making bread and would always have a few loaves left over, which we would save throughout the week, and you wouldn't want to throw it out, and there's only so much bread you can eat. So I started to experiment with what we could be doing with our bread. So turning it into bread pastry for tarts. And then I produced this bread cracker, which I've kept on the menu ever since. And now working with CSIRO to kind of develop that a bit further which is really exciting because it's a, you wouldn't even know it's made out of kind of waste.
When you say develop it further, what are you looking to do with it, Jo?
I guess try and help people reduce waste and then potentially help some of the bigger industry in Australia combat some of the problems that they're having. So, you know, food waste, especially in the bakery world, is really big in Australia. And it's not intentional. I don't think anyone produces food waste intentionally, but a lot of it goes to animal feed. And I think that we could also be eating it ourselves. It's delicious, this bread cracker that we've developed. It kind of has a similar texture to a prawn cracker or like a rice cracker.
Yum, yum.
But it's 100% bread.
Has there been a resistance in the industry to what you're doing, or is there actually sort of, people coming on board with it, Jo?
Oh, I think everyone just wants a solution. No one wants to throw out food. I think it's costly, for one, but also I think people are just looking for solutions, which is really exciting. I think people are a bit time poor. So, you know, if we can develop this product a bit further and help people feel good about themselves or potentially help them reduce waste in their own home, I think it's a great thing.
Philip, you mentioned earlier that you were quite across the work that Jo had been doing. I mean, when we look, I guess, specifically at that bakery industry at bread, I mean, does that make a huge difference, the work that's being done?
Absolutely, and I've been lucky enough to try Jo's cracker, and it's an absolute cracker. and in terms of the industry, I mean, Jo, you know, there's, I think the numbers are 320,000 tonnes of bread each year. That's about 450 million loaves of bread going to waste. And again, a lot of that bread is, you know, something that, what Jo was talking about, you know, you can really transform it and extend the shelf life. I'm just looking forward, really excited to see whether we can get this sort of cracker into the through to the consumers, because I think it will be. It's got a great story as well as being, you know, a really great product. So, but Jo, I wanted to ask you as well. I mean, from a, you know, in terms of a zero chef mentality in your book, you know, are we going to see a, you know, a master chef that's where the pantry is all food waste, perhaps, you know? Are we going to see that? What do you think about that idea?
I think that would be an awesome idea. I think when you have restrictions placed on you or a bit of a challenge, you become really creative. You know, we had another dish at Oak Ridge where we were peeling potatoes to make a potato puree. So we were taking all of the skins and made a dessert out of all the potato skins.
A dessert? But,
yeah, I think it breeds creativity when you get faced with a challenge like that. So I think it's a great idea. And I think chefs around Melbourne and around Australia are really embracing that.
And Jo, I guess as you were kind of, we were laughing about it before, but by mainstreaming it, by getting it in the media, it stops being I guess the province of elite chefs and start being something that we can all talk about.
Yeah, if only we could change the wording and it not be waste. I think it would be even further adopted, you know, or secondary cut, you know, that kind of language around it. I started off by calling that cracker yesterday's bread, but then I'm thinking maybe it should be called tomorrow's bread.
Oh, I like calling it tomorrow's bread. It's very, very good. Jo, thank you so much for your time this morning, and congratulations on the work you are doing. Jo Barrett's book, and I do recommend you getting a copy of it, Sustain Ground Baking Recipes and Skills That Could Save the Planet. And Philip, before I let you go, obviously, if we're using it, it's not waste anymore. I mean, that's the great kind of takeaway from all of this.
Absolutely, and I think the terminology that we use to describe food waste, you know, we sometimes say it's loss, food loss, or it's, you know, something that's a leftover. So I think that's changing as well. I think the perceptions, the perception of consumers as to how we look at that and the understanding. So there's a bit of an education piece there. But I think overall, you know, just getting the messages out there, and food manufacturing, obviously there's these really ambitious plans and strategy, and now there's a benchmark to reduce our food waste by 2030. So it will be really interesting to see what happens next over the next 5 to 6 years as we, you know, head towards that target. And there is a sort of a soft target of you know, 11% reduction by 2025, which is just around the corner. So I think we've got, you know, still lots of work to do. We do need, you know, lots of collaboration. I think that's the key, you know, bringing industry and private and public partnerships together to make it all happen. Otherwise, I think we will, you know, not get there. But I think, yeah, we're really optimistic. This is a challenge that we can solve if we pull together.
Philip Janikiewski, you've been incredibly generous with your time this morning, and thank you so much. Philip is Senior Engineer at CSIRO's Agriculture and Food Division. He specialises in process and product development. And while we are talking on this topic, just to say again, we need to look at food waste as a holistic problem. We can't just narrow it down to what you and I do in the kitchen or what's happening in a restaurant. It's got to be taken absolutely everywhere. And I thank you to everyone who's got in touch with some of the ways they're managing food waste in their own homes. Tomorrow, you and I are going to look at regional newspapers. You might have seen a decline in yours. Depending on where you live, your regional newspaper might have had to pack up after many, many decades, even over a century of operation. For a lot of regional communities, they've been a vital voice. They've been the paper of record, but they are facing some hard yards at the moment. So let's talk to some of the people in the industry and work out what we need to do to keep the future bright for regional papers.